All right, folks, this will be an episode of Call Me Ignorant, the podcast, a little bit later. It's going to drop Tuesdays at 5 p.m., so this will come out as a standalone episode next week. But I'm very excited to have our guest on today. He goes by Thomas777. He was, not necessarily recommended, but he's been on the Pete Quinonez show many times. Pete is a friend of the show. And I don't know too much what to say about this guy as a bio or a description, but I liked how Pete Quinonez put it one time, that Thomas777 is the history teacher that we all wished we had. So we're going to get a little bit into his background. We're going to get a little bit into some World War history. That's going to be the subject matter of the day. But let's bring the guy on in here and see if everything's working out. Hello, Thomas777. How you doing?
I'm very well. Thanks for hosting me.
Yeah, this is fun. I've been a fan for a long time. I encountered your work through Pete Quinonez, as I said, and you've done a lot of episodes with him. And why don't we just start with doing a little background about you? I've heard some, I don't know if I want to call them stories or, whatever. What was your upbringing life like? How did you come to be in this sphere and be dealing with these type of ideas in the so-called dissident right? What's your background like?
I mean, I had something of a peculiar upbringing, probably. I don't mean that in negative terms. I had a great upbringing in most ways. But, I grew up on the North Shore of Chicago. And my folks, my mom was, very much like a WASP, like rich girl. Like, her dad was like a surgeon and stuff. Like, my dad was literally, like a poor Okie who grew up in Hollywood when West Hollywood was kind of a white ghetto, abutting a similarly situated, Mexican hood. So they were kind of an odd pairing. But long story short, anywhere in Chicago is very ethnic, and those kind of dividing lines are very much are very much intact and visible in a way that isn't the case in a lot of places. I mean, Boston is still like that. Philly is still like that. So is Baltimore and stuff. But, I was always very kind of self-conscious of, my own background, just because there's no way, I could not be. I grew up in a hood that was, half, Irish and Slavic and Baltic peoples and half Jewish. And I was this son of a WASPy lady and this Okie guy who, went to a reformed, Calvinist church. Don't get me wrong, the North Shore is dope. I'm glad that I got to grow up there, and I was happy to come back to live here, just a few years back, which was the first time I'd returned here to live, since I left home when I was 19. But you are, if you're a wood, you're a white Protestant, who's at all redneckish, you're very much aware of that, here, Chi-Town is not remotely liberal, despite what Jagoff's like the bandy on the internet, it's very much its own kind of ecosystem, socially, culturally, and otherwise, but you're very much a minority if you're a peckerwood or redneck or whatever, and which is fine. I'm never, the white man's always a minority anyway. God gives us these challenges because he knows we can handle them, and plus it's not something anybody should run from. I don't even know if it's, I don't even know if it's a net negative anymore, considering the historical situation. But that was basically my upbringing. And because I'm old, when I was a kid, really your only access to academic materials was what you could find at your local library, or if you had access to, a university library system, you had kind of a wider reach, as it were. I got interested in, in the late 80s, early 90s, I got interested in, and what I think of as culture war stuff, because those were very volatile times, especially 89 to 94, 95, so race and stuff was on the forefront of everybody's mind. The international situation in a very punctuated way. There'd been this huge paradigm shift with the end of the Cold War. It really kind of seemed like stuff was coming apart at the seams, and that sort of forced a confrontation in the mind of anybody who was at all, engaged with anything, with what his race meant to him and stuff. And so mired in that milieu as I was anyway, that I described of being kind of like, a minority of one on the North Shore and being intellectually curious. I started studying World War II. I started studying my own people's heritage and stuff, and thankfully, my folks, whatever problems they may have had, they always, my dad especially, fed my kind of like intellectual voraciousness, by buying me books all the time and turning me on to stuff that he thought would help with my own kind of self-education. And that's not to say my folks, my mom's long passed away, but it's not to say my dad is, shares my opinions at all or like views, but he always made it a point to, take pride in like your heritage and like stand on business as, like a white person. So I just started studying everything I could, both of a critical nature and of, and of a kind of mainstream. I started reading a lot of like what mainstream court history asserted, and realizing just as, I kind of developed an understanding of the historical, the process of historical analysis and historiography, I started realizing that this didn't make any sense. This was entirely politically driven. The narratives that were presented as unimpeachable fact about the 20th century, particularly about the world wars, and especially about the Second War. But I started learning, more and more became apparent, things kind of came into high relief, if you'll allow the metaphor, of how these macro narratives came to touch and concern every sort of aspect of, the sociocultural architecture that the regime had propped up to manage human relations and to establish the parameters of what's acceptable discourse and to, kind of erect a sort of ersatz, like civic morality bordering on like a theological imperative, like around these purported, truths, of the 20th century, relating to, relating to like race and morality and like and telluric utopias whereby, we somehow transcend these things. Why we would want to was never actually answered either. But that's how I got into, revisionist kind of thought and scholarship. And I started writing a whole lot and just seeking out other people like me. And I was an early adapter on the internet, not because I was a tech guy, but if you were like a historical revisionist type, or if you were like at all like truly right wing, you'd hop on Usenet. If you'd there'd be like these like Rothbard libertarians on there, there'd be like white nationalist guys. We had a revisionist group and it was like literally like nine people and like everybody fucking hated us. And like if you had like five guys, like in your IRC chat, like that was considered like a big deal and like you were like really doing well. And other than that, there was stuff like the, Tommy Metzger's like war newsletter, like White Iron Resistance. The IHR, they put out like they put out an irregular newsletter, but it's like this stuff had a circulation of like 50 people or something. You know what I mean? That was considered like the best you could hope for. I mean, nobody gets into like this kind of dissident scholarship type stuff or this kind of activism, if you want to look at it that way, to make money. Or I mean, if they do, they're a fool because that's a, it's completely retarded. But there really was like no, there really was no money to be had in those days. Like you'd be eating a loss on if you were putting out a zine or, or doing anything like that. And but I kept at it. And with a hiatus, my life got pretty derailed for about 9 years. I mean, this is life. Like, I mean, things like that happen. And when I kind of came back to the land of the living, and like my legal problems and like my addiction problems are behind me and stuff, people started reaching out to me, telling me that, that stuff I've been writing on the internet over the last 20 years. I guess people were still like into it, and it was actually like kind of popping. And I found that fascinating. So at first, this was around 2020, I just got back online and started kind of like looking around, and I realized that that was true, which I found to be like incredible. I don't think, I mean, I'm not, so being self-deprecating isn't a good look, and I don't do that. But at the same time, I didn't think I was doing anything like amazing that, other revisionists hadn't done before. But I think I contextualize things in a way that other revisionists haven't. But point being, within our circles, which had grown exponentially, from the time I kind of quit, my public profile to the time I reemerged, there was a tremendous growth and receptivity for that sort of content and scholarship. And so I started just, I started like getting my feet wet a little bit again. And at first, like, people didn't believe me that I was Thomas. Like, they'd be like, "No, man, Thomas died like a long time ago." And they'd say this like in dead earnest.
Wow.
They'd be like, "You're," and they're like, "You're an asshole for like saying you're him. How would his family feel if you were?" I'm like, "Bro, like that's not true." And then I mean, it's like funny in hindsight, but at the time, like, it wasn't particularly funny.
Yeah, sure.
But and plus it's like macabre too, like people telling you like you're dead. It's like that,
Yeah.
well, that's fucked up. I don't want to hear that. But
Wow.
then I started, so I just started I just kind of jump started this content brand, man. Like, I set up a Substack, and some guys started reaching out to me who wanted me to like come on their pods and stuff, and like that's basically just like what happened, man. And here we are, that was like fall, October 2020, when I got back to writing and got back online, and now here we are, like 3.5 years later. And that's basically, I realized I was long-winded, man. I hope I didn't put everyone to bed.
No,
But that was,
not me.
yeah,
I'm
that was like,
the only audience that matters here. They can, I'm interested in it, man. Yeah.
yeah, that's, I mean, that's big. And you mentioned Pete Quinones, I think, before I went live. Like, he's an awesome individual. Like, I mean that. Like, he's a real prince, man. Like, not just because he's like a good dude and he puts out solid content, but I mean, he didn't know me from Adam. I was just like some random guy who, wrote some revisionist kind of stuff that he liked, and he reached out to me and started like, avidly plugging my content, and that was huge.
Yeah.
There's a whole laundry list of guys who are willing to help and really enthusiastic at the prospect of kind of helping me hit the ground running. And that's fantastic. I mean, not just because obviously it helped me get to a place where I can kind of pursue this stuff full time, but anybody who keeps up with my content knows that social capital was kind of like my whole jive, and rebuilding social capital as the as a path, not just to nullification of the regime's power over us, but also to, kind of reclaiming a communitarian destiny. I take that very seriously. And in its own like small way, just like in my life, like that, I owe that tendency and that impulse to, me being able to be a full-time content creator. So yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Before we get into the World War II thing, I do want to, you mentioned a couple things that I want to ask about. And people are kind of commenting in the chat about how it was tough times for a so-called dissident or white identitarian or whatever the label might be. And I came very late to the party. I've only been in this sphere since about mid 2020 or so, maybe late 2020. And I think no one would argue with that there's been exponential growth in the spreading of these ideas over the past several years, maybe over the past 5 or 6. What do you attribute that to? Why do you think it's gone so-called viral, or that it's spread and become more accepted? It's not dinner time conversation yet, but it might be soon. So what do you attribute that to, since you've been around the scene for so long?
Well, it's like I was telling a couple months back, Keith Woods, he's a great dude too. I don't know if people watching or listening are familiar with Keith or not, but if they're not, you should seek him out. He's an Irish guy and he's a very, 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 very learned dude. But I ran into him in Nashville and we hung out for a minute and we laid some audio and he kind of posed the same question. And I always knew that at some point there would be a groundswell of reaction against regime values because the proverbial center just can't hold. Okay. And America's a lot more like the late Soviet Union than it is like any other regime, and not just in living memory, but in the modern era, in my opinion. And people forget that the regime as it exists now was basically, it's a legacy structure of a 1933 kind of revolutionary restructuring of government. You don't live under like the legacy government of John Adams or something. Like that's just silly. Like you don't. Okay. Like that's there's no connection other than some loose kind of, like linear geography in literal terms between, like the founders and us. Okay. And that's a as everything else aside from the fact that, the regime as described is like openly Zionist. It's like it's anti-white because it's anti it's not just anti-white, like it assaults like any identitarian imperative that threatens it, and anything and any people who are capable of living historically threaten it. I mean, that's kind of a tangent, but the but aside from all of that, aside from its values and its goals being insidious, it's a 20th century paradigm that doesn't have a context anymore. So if nothing else, I knew that that's what would bring down the regime and the culture that sort of sustained it. I didn't think it would happen this fast. I figured it would probably happen after I was dead. I figured it would probably happen, in like the 2080s or something. This is the way I thought, like in the 90s and early 2000s. A couple things happened. I don't see America having like a November 9th, 1989 moment. The regime's dying by a thousand cuts, but there were some punctuated occurrences that sort of exposed the kind of like rottenness within, but also the lack of, the true kind of lack of a mandate that it really had. One of those was 9/11, okay, which crippled America's ability to project power effectively while sustaining any kind of legitimacy in doing so, other than the inherent legitimacy that flows from the barrel of a gun. And it might not seem terribly relevant, but if you consider only 10 years prior, you had George W. Bush and Gorbachev, shaking hands across the aisle while Bush and Baker, corralled a coalition of literally dozens of countries, including Hafez Assad, Syria, to wage a general war on Iraq. Like, I mean that's this is remarkable. Like America basically went from zenith to gutter, like in the blink of an eye. Okay. I mean, obviously there was underlying frailties there that made that possible, that over time were, having a deleterious effect on the regime's ability to pursue its goals and function effectively, even in day-to-day terms, let alone hard power political terms. But the point is that despite the fact that this is like a long kind of drawn out sickness that's killing it, there were some punctuated events that dramatically exacerbated the process. Like the 2008 like crash was another one. Okay. When it became laid bare that, essentially since the Clinton like bank restructuring, basically since the creation of universal banks, this like mass looting operation was underway. And that's like all that it was. It's not even like this was, kind of like an imperfect way of like building short-term equity, to like win the Cold War or to you know, like inject some kind of like proverbial nitro into you know, a kind of like new national economics or something. Like it was literally just like looting.
Yeah.
It was just like a glorified version of like third world bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of like made people realize, like, you know, they realized that the man by the curtain is just like robbing us blind. He's, you know. And finally, the way the regime just kind of like lost its mind in 2016,
Yeah.
you know, like broke with reality. You know, it was like obvious. It was obvious that Donald Trump was going to get elected president. That wasn't weird. It wasn't some outlier sort of tendency. When Wisconsin voters went for Bernie instead of Hillary, like Pat Buchanan said at the time, like that kind of that's when like the fix was in. But let's say Hillary Clinton is just, she's probably the most hated political figure of the last 100 years. And you know, these like delusional freaks at like the New York Times, like saying that Hillary Clinton's like a really good candidate. Like people literally just out of touch with reality in like a late Soviet kind of way. And then when, in an entirely predictable way, you know, the silent majority went to the polls and voted for Trump, like these people like utterly lost their mind. And it was really, really, really weird to watch. You know, so you have this like deep state apparatus like going into like trembling rages, like when things don't go their way in a totally predictable election that they basically fucked up from jump by not backing an electable candidate. You know, that's not the way regimes that are built for posterity function. You know, like you've got total cripples at the helm, if that's what's happening. So that's kind of my diagnosis, if you want to know like why,
Yeah.
like the dissident right, or you know, why it developed this kind of mass momentum the way it did after, yeah, like being totally marginalized for decades. Like that's
Yeah.
why.
Wow. Yeah, very good analysis. I love that. So let's get into World War II, or you know, you can't really talk about World War II without talking about World War I, and I almost don't know where to start. I mean, have been called, I think you called yourself a historical revisionist earlier. I mean, so I guess we can start with kind of the big picture. What do you think? And I know that you've done, just to plug Pete's show, I mean, you've done, I think, a 6 or 7 part series on this with Pete. You've done a bunch of content with him. But what do you think that the mainstream or the regime narrative gets the most wrong about the two wars, the intra-war period? What do you think that they get wrong, like the big chunks? What do you think they're mainly
I
wrong
mean,
about?
again, if you're talking about what like literally what the government presents,
Yeah.
you know, in its in the kinds of in the kinds of academia that it funds, and in the public school system, and in the kinds of you know, documentarian endeavors that it supports. I mean, it gets like everything wrong because it's trying to get everything wrong, because
Okay.
it's presenting a punitive ideological narrative to shore up its own credibility and to cast its enemies as incorrigibly evil. So that's everything about that is wrong, because it's a fantasy, it's a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale about the martyrdom and challenges of the Jewish people, like fighting their enemies who are incorrigibly evil and so evil to as not be human. Like that's what the regime's like claim of World War II is, that there's this group of people called Jews who are just like everybody else, but just follow, like, you know, an older religion. And the Germans are the most evil people who ever lived. They went totally insane, and so did the Japanese, you know, who are also evil but kind of like less developed, you know. And what the Germans did was they conspired. The control group of the Third Reich met at Wannsee, and they conspired to murder every single Jewish person on Earth just to be evil. And then they launched this crusade to conquer the entire planet in order to effect that murder conspiracy. That's literally what they claim.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's preposterous beyond all belief. Like that's like that, you know, that's like on the level of like Marvel Comics or something. So
Yeah.
there's nothing to say about that, because it's too cuckoo.
Yeah.
More serious people, like what they get wrong is like this idea. I mean, here's the problem with basically like the post kind of Westphalian paradigm anyway. And they look at warfare through this the lens of legalese in some way, you know, where there's like aggressors and defenders, you know, or there's like or there's you know nation states, the governments of which, you know, like are acting in the right and those who are in the wrong. Like that's not the classical view of warfare. Is that war arrives like the seasons, you know? It's whether you believe in God or not, whether you think that you know its arrival owes to providential design, or whether you just accept that you know sociological phenomena, its scale is too complicated and the inputs are too numerous for us to decipher and understand, but that there, you know in some cyclical capacity, like war arrives and you know people are swept up in it, its fervor and its intense energies. You know that's the traditional view of war. This idea that you know guys, whether they're generals or whether they're you know big capitalists or whatever, or whoever the villain of the day is, can has they have the power to like sit around and conspire to like start a war? Like that's not possible. You know, like that's like men aren't like sorcerers who can do that. Okay, there's certainly people who profit from warfare. You know, there's certainly people who, there's certainly people who facilitate, you know, at key junctures within a conflict paradigm, you know, who like facilitate, you know, one outcome over the other. But like this idea that, you know, wars break out between aggressors, between states, owing to, you know, owing to the, you know, a designated aggressor and a designated victim, like that's preposterous. So there's that. So, I mean, if you're gonna, whether you're, you know, whether you're a kind of hard and fast historian, or whether you're like a military science type, that's the way you approach it. Your epistemic priors are all wrong. Okay. Secondly, what they get wrong is the way you've got to look at the way you got to look at the 20th century is kind of a singular event in geostrategic and power political terms. And in and in dialectical terms, you've got to look at it as you know, basically like one event beginning in 1914 and ending on November 9th, 1989, you know, whereby the processes that gave rise to and caused the Great War, World War II, and the Cold War, and you know, the internecine battles therein all derive from a common like nucleus of operative fact. Okay. This idea that World War I happened and then, oh, the Germans were poor and they were mad that they lost, so they found this crazy guy, Adolf Hitler. Like that's completely basic, and that's totally off, you know, at odds with the way historical phenomena actually develop. The emergence of a messianic personage, I mean in political terms, not in like theological terms, like Hitler is actually very well precedented. His peers basically are people like Cromwell, like Muhammad, and like Napoleon. And within the kind of paradigm emergent that is described in the 20th century, it would have been unusual if a man like Hitler hadn't emerged. Like Hitler was remarkably effective in his role, just like Napoleon was. But you know, the messianic personages arrive when the zeitgeist like kind of demands they arrive. Okay, so there's that. And finally, this kind of even people who are basically, you know, reasonable and aren't abiding a nakedly ideological program in the way they describe the war and its proximate and ultimate causes, they still abide this sort of anti-fascist sensibility. It's like everything they write, it's going to be colored by, you know, but oh, like, you know, horrible things happen at war, but the Nazis were still the worst people ever. Or, you know, Joseph Stalin may have presided over a government that killed 10 million people before a shot was fired in World War II, but Hitler was way worse because Hitler was a racist who just killed people because of their race. It's clear that, and the degree to which people do this because they're constantly genuflecting before what's become kind of the civic religion, and the degree to which they don't even realize they're doing it, that's a curious question. And it's actually an important question. I've thought about that before. And I should probably write more on it. But I mean, it's an utterly massive topic. I've like devoted my entire life to studying it, but that's my whole point though, too. Like, I'm well aware of my limitations, and they are many, but I'm also aware of my strengths. I'm 47 years old. I've literally spent my entire life studying World War II in the 20th century. I think there's a pretty good chance I know what I'm talking about, at least in some rudimentary sense.
Yes.
I'll come across people and they'll be like, "But Hitler was like evil." I'd be like,
I've never heard that.
"What were the what, I'd be like, what were the five most significant engagements of World War II?" I'd be like, "Where was Hitler born? What was Hitler's parentage? What was that parentage like? Hitler that was a Habsburg Austrian. Like, what? How was his culture different from that of these like Prussian martinets who he was dealing with on the general staff? What historically like." What's the meaning of Sondervig? And like, is that a real thing or not? And like, they just like give me like a blank look, and they're just like, no, like Hitler's like racist and stuff and like bad. Like there's not, it like doesn't compute.
Oh,
But it's like,
man.
if you're not qualified to speak on stuff, you should just keep your mouth shut. And I don't know, at some point, like people decided that, they decided that, like, because they watch Hollywood movies or something, that like they have standing to speak on, like meta historical events. Like it's crazy. And I mean, and that's not to say that people need to like accept like my view of things, because I mean, I do have my own sympathies, my own like aesthetic preferences and stuff that do like color my opinions. But I'm not talking about, I'm not dealing in opinions, but I'm talking about the meaning of the 20th century, simply presenting it as some sort of like anti-fascist fair like fable or like parable. That's not up to snuff, and that's not that's the that's basically just people abiding in however a rudimentary or dedicated way, like what amounts to the state religion. So I mean that's so I consider I think God put me on earth to kind of put historical phenomenon in context, especially as regards like our people and our people's fortunes, but not just us. Essentially, in my own small way, do my part to return integrity to the historical record. That's yeah, and I mean, and again too, like I do a lot of stuff outside of just like writing. In the interest of like we talked about a minute ago, building social capital and things, but that's kind of a discussion for a different episode, I think. But yeah, that's
Great answer. So I mean, it's one thing. I mean, it's one thing I talk about a lot on my show is that this is one of the pitfall. The people that that go to you and say, "But Hitler was evil and he was like a bad man." This is one of the pitfalls of this type of liberal individualism that is our society is all about. Everyone gets an equal vote. Everyone gets an equal opinion, and your opinion as a person that's seen Schindler's List twice is just as valid as a guy that's dedicated his life to studying it. But that's why I don't know what I would call myself. We were talking about labels earlier in before you came on air, and I just kind of know what I oppose, and I oppose that. I kind of am in a way an elitist, or I believe in an aristocracy, and I believe in expertise and people and a hierarchy. In terms of people have paid their dues, they can speak in fa dispassionately about facts without saying mean Mr. Mustache is bad man, and that's why we need to be a nation controlled by Jews. I mean, it just makes Absolutely no sense. But let's, you know, kind of to narrow the focus a little bit, let's talk about just putting Hitler in context. I mean, I know you can go and we can go in all kinds of different directions, but you can compare him to, a non-theological, a historical messianic figure like Napoleon, Muhammad, and many figures like this. But just why don't you frame the rise of Adolf Hitler a little bit for us? People know the talking points, or this is a person that has been paraded falsely in the media and academia for decades, of course. So why don't you just put him in what you think his proper historical context is and how you see him as a figure?
Well, there's a number of dimensions of that. It's notable that Adolf Hitler was an artist and that Joseph Stalin was a lapsed priest. Like Stalin actually attended a seminary.
Yeah.
And according to him, like one day he like lost faith and ceased believing in God. So he took to going out to the garden to urinate on the icons to like disrespect them. Stalin is kind of like this, almost demonic priestly figure. It's kind of the key to understanding his ascendancy. Just like Hitler, the artist, is the key to understanding Adolf Hitler. That's one of the reasons why it's corny. One of the things like Americans really don't understand is that they think that like National Socialism and like the Third Reich was like the Republican Party on steroids or something. Like they don't basically they hated conservatives.
Yeah.
You know, like almost as much as they did social democrats. And there's a reason, there's a reason why people responded to Hitler in that epoch beyond the obvious. And I make the point to people a lot. Like just the other day, me and my friend Ace were talking about on a live stream. We're talking about how in America, kind of like the sovereign art forms are film, obviously. Because there's still like incredible movies made in Europe and stuff. But everybody associates Hollywood with film and there's also the great kind of like American novel is like a thing. It's almost like a trope unto itself. But in Europe, like visual art and like painting and kind of like the traditional like Renaissance, creative arts was something that had like a lot of evocative power. And, like real ideological battles were kind of waged, in the arts, I find that kind of fascinating. I mean, maybe because I'm so much a writer and, not at all like, I mean, I'm an appreciator of visual art, but I can't like draw anything beyond like stick figures. But the Hitler is this like kind of visionary shaman type who quite literally had a vision to restructure Europe into this kind of like nation Europa that was both hyper modern and transcendent and futurist terms, but also tethered inextricably to the racial core of the past and committed to its posterity. Like that kind of thing could only really be emergent from like the mind of an artist. Otherwise, it wouldn't. Otherwise, it wouldn't really make sense, or it would seem, kind of pointlessly abstract, or a number of other things. So I mean that's the key to understanding Hitler in part. It's also I mean there's so many things, and it's also Hitler was a Habsburg Austrian, okay? But he identified I advise anybody who wants to learn a lot about the war or have a complete picture of Hitler to read the December 11th, 1941 speech to the Reichstag, when Hitler's talking about the situation on the Eastern Front, which at that moment the Wehrmacht had been halted at Moscow, Hitler said, "We've been here before," in 1813. Like what he's referring to is when the Prussian army was fighting with Napoleon in Russia, and the Prussians are the only German kingdom who joined Napoleon in that assault. So Hitler, the Habsburg Austrian, is talking about the Kingdom of Prussia as "we," and that's hugely significant because it definitely begs the question, this kind of creative genius, like visionary Habsburg Austrian artist. Like, how could he build a coalition, between people like himself and kind of, his people's cousins in Bavaria, and these upright Prussians, who and with their Lutheran pietism and their kind of gross intolerance of everybody they feel is like not up to their standard. It seems completely against both chance and reason that Hitler could unite Germany the way that he did.
Wow.
So I mean, that, but there, but that's why, because I mean, Hitler was he was like the consummate he was like a consummate Habsburg Austrian, but who viewed Germany as quite literally like the legacy of the Prussian kingdom and its perfection, and like embodied within that sort of racial soul, like if you want to look at it like that, is kind of like the core of like the German people as like a Volk, in more kind of metaphysical terms. Some guys just embody the zeitgeist, and that's one of the reasons they believe in God. Mohammed was a guy. He was from a merchant clan. So he wasn't poor, but he wasn't particularly wealthy, and he didn't have any real like pedigree behind him, and he didn't have any religious training. Like one day, Muhammad claimed that, and he had no military background. One day, Muhammad claimed that, he had like a visionary experience. He proceeded to raise an army and conquer like a good portion of the planet, as it was known then, That like what are the odds of that happening? Ditto like Cromwell one day when he was about 40 years old, he suddenly became like radically pious in his commitments and his confession. He raised an army, he killed a king, and arguably created like the first like modern republic, like it's so I mean Hitler's in that vein, if you don't believe in God, okay, I mean I'm not gonna sit here and argue that point with people or club them over the head with what I think they should believe, but there's obviously something totally out of the ordinary at work with the fortunes of men like this, even if it's just again to a materialistic cause or set of causes, that are just too complicated and too numerously clustered for us to decipher. But Hitler's for some reason somehow more than any other man embodied the zeitgeist, and he became the Führer. That's how.
Wow. Very fascinating. One thing that I've, we did a segment a couple weeks ago reading through the Nazi or the National Socialist 25 points, and I did that as well back in 2020. And I was basically a recovering libertarian at the time in 2020. Reread it this time, and I was just like, man, this is frankly pretty good stuff. I'm already, doxxed and canceled or whatever. I feel like I'm in a weird place, and I don't know what God has put me here to do, but it's kind of to laugh and smile about the whole thing while still being pretty right wing or whatever. But I was like, this makes a lot of sense. If you were to just take the label off of it and just read those points, it would make a lot of sense to, I think, most people actually. But one of
Well, it's
the uh,
also
oh God.
the this is kind of a tangent, but the early National Socialist Party, like Max von Suttner-Richter, he died at the Munich Putsch, at the Beer Hall Putsch. He when the National Socialists charged the police cordon, Richter like locked arms with Hitler, and he got shot and killed by
Whoa.
police gunfire. And like when he fell, like dislocated Hitler's arm. But Richter, Hitler said, was the one man that, like, the Nazi Party could not have afforded to lose. And he was a fascinating guy, and he fought with the Free Corps against the communists in the Baltic. He was this Baltic German aristocrat, but long story short, he was a liaison to the Ottoman army late in the war, and he witnessed the Armenian genocide, and he began alerting the world media about it. And he was told in no uncertain terms by the foreign ministry in Berlin, like, look, we don't know what's going to develop in Turkey, but we need all the allies we can get, and we're still hoping that we can finesse some kind of less than catastrophic outcome, in the Near East. So just basically, like quash this, like stop talking about it. So the supposedly, the Nazis are these like illiterate morons who just like hate everybody and like go around genociding everybody. It's like, well, it's interesting that they attracted guys like Richter then. I mean, like, don't get me wrong, like during total war, like Rosenkrieg, like absolutely horrible things happen. And certainly, as much as Germany carried out as much homicide at scale as all the other combatants did, because that's total war. But this idea that this idea that the Germans are this kind of like hyper racialized and implicitly like genocidally violent like view of the world, kind of apropos of nothing and not even incident to a total war context. I mean, that's obviously asinine, but I hold out the case of Richter to impeach that claim. But also, Richter was like a winner. He could have written his own ditto. I mean, ditto for Goering. Goering had terrible personal problems. He was an addict, and he was kind of his own worst enemy. But he commanded Richthofen Squadron after the Red Baron went down in action. I mean, he was and he married a Swedish princess. He was a partner in what became Lufthansa, which was the world's first profitable commercial airline. It's like, why? It's like, if the National Socialists were these like big losers, like why did all these like guys like who had so much going for them in life like join up with them? Like, no one can explain that. It's like just because they're like Darth Vader and they want to do bad things. Like, it doesn't, that's not the way like human life is.
No, not at all. Yeah. Wow. So, one of the points that I wanted to ask you about, and I'm it's a little bit of a longer excerpt here. I'm going to read one of them because we do have a couple of people asking in the chat about Hitler and the National Socialists and their relationship with Christianity. And this is one of the ones that I still am pretty new to. I don't really know. And I am a Christian, just for the record. And so let me read the 24th point. And I've heard some conflicting viewpoints about this, but I'm interested to see what you say about this. But it says, "We demand freedom of religion for all religious denominations within the state, so long as they do not endanger its existence or oppose the moral senses of the Germanic race. The party, as such, advocates the standpoint of a positive Christianity without binding itself confessionally to any one denomination. It combats the Jewish materialistic spirit within and around us and is convinced that a lasting recovery of our nation can only succeed from within on the framework, common utility precedes individual utility." So what do they mean by positive Christianity? What was the Reich's relationship with Christianity? And also, this is written in 1920, I believe. So Hitler, obviously he rose to prominence, I think, just right around this time. So what is your take on positive
The thing
Christianity, what that
is,
is, and that whole thing?
people don't understand the degree to which this was not an issue at all. First of all, in the 20th century, one of the reasons why it was a huge deal in the 70s when a few things happened. There was this huge Catholic revival, and like Pope John Paul became this big celebrity. And then you had stuff like, the Bobby Sands, hunger strike, which was an instance of, like contemporary like Catholic martyrdom. Then you had the Mujahideen in Afghanistan jumping off. You had the Iranian Revolution. You had the occupation of the Grand Mosque. Basically, like, religion came back like with a vengeance and was a one aspect of tearing down the Stalinist East Bloc. In the 1920s, nobody thought that way. the viewpoint was religion's dead, God is dead, you know, religion's important for moral learning or for, you know, tradition's sake, but, you know, it's the future, there's not really going to be a place for it. So, like, it wasn't on anybody's mind, you know, outside of provincial territories like the NDH and, like, Slovakia and, like, Romania, where it still had, like, cultural power that translated to political might. But, I mean, even in Spain, you know, like, the kind of Schwerpunkt of the nationalist forces was the Falange, and, I mean, they were, like, nominally Catholic, but not really. You know, this... the nationalist view of Christianity is exactly what you just read, and it's exactly what Hitler said it was. And I'd argue National Socialism itself, it basically is... It's basically the logical progression in political terms of German pietism, you know, kind of secularized and interpreted as a political doctrine, you know, whereby the inner witness, you know, is kind of like the racial consciousness that, you know, is supposed to guide action in, you know, communitarian capacities. And it's kind of like, you know, the arbiter of what's moral, like, in the person's own interrogation of his values and his actions. You know, like this idea that, and people had to pull out like some moronic statement by Martin Bormann, who said all kinds of moronic things about how like he hated the church. Yeah, he probably did. And you know what? Nobody gave a fuck. You know, it just wasn't, you know, it's just the degree to which people thought religion was dead and was not coming back, like, can't be overstated. That's how communism conquered a good part of this planet. Okay. What was positive Christianity? One of the Gauleiters who was assigned, his name eludes me, man. I'm having a senior moment, which were increasingly common. The Gauleiter who was assigned responsibility for liaising with German churches, Catholic and Protestant, I cannot remember his name. He devised a sort of like loose kind of philosophical concept of positive Christianity, which is basically deist, you know, like it acknowledges providence as, you know, the prime mover of human affairs as well as like the creator of the universe, but it's basically worldly, you know, and emphasizes the New Testament, and in some way, and in some congregations, it was even suggested that the Old Testament should be removed altogether. It didn't catch on because it was very much, you know, that kind of attempt to politicize religious practice at the congregational level, like, never catches on, you know, but it was kind of quickly forgotten about because, again, like, it wasn't an issue, you know. It just wasn't. And plus, too, I mean, it's, you know, some National Socialists were pagan, some were Christian. I mean, Leon Degrelle was as Catholic as they come, and he held the Knight's Cross. I'm going to take his word over what some, like, internet guy says about the matter, okay?
Yep.
Yeah. You know, and it's also, I mean, in Germany, you know, there's an interfaith tension between paganism. I'm talking, like, real paganism. I don't mean like, guys and fat chicks, like, dressing up like elves or something. Like, I mean, like... And like actual like pagan impulses and archetypes and things like that. That's like a real thing. And that kind of tension in Indo-European peoples. And I believe Germans, especially, that kind of tension between like Christianity and Logos and, you know, like the pagan racial soul, like that's a real, real, that's a very real thing. Okay. But like, it's not this idea that the way that manifests is like, there's two camps where it's like, oh, there's like Christianity and it's Jewish. And there's like, you know, then there's like, you know, being a Viking pagan, and like, it's like, that's fucking retarded. But yeah, that's people are always asking me about this, which is fine. I'm not, don't take it the wrong way. I'm not saying I'm like mad about that, but we should do a dedicated stream on it if that's like what you want to focus on, because it's like a one off kind of thing. Like, it's a huge topic.
Gotcha. Cool, man. Well, yeah, we're winding down our time here, and it's you know, we've obviously barely scratched the surface, and I think that that's okay. You know, before we get you to plug your stuff in a couple of minutes, why don't you just give us some, you know, what books are there to read? I mean, you already gave the speech, the 1941 Reichstag speech. Like, if people want to learn more about this, whether it be a podcast or I don't know if you, this is the type of material on your Substack, but how can people learn more about this from a, you know, if you want to break free of the, you know, the liberal Jewish machine that we're in right now?
I mean, World War II, John Toland is essential. He's a seminal biography of Adolf Hitler, seminal biographer. He was the only historian who Hitler's family would speak to, among other things. And the book's just called Adolf Hitler. That's essential reading. Pretty much everything David Irving wrote, including his most recent book, which is a Himmler biography, which almost certainly is going to be Irving's last book. You know, Irving covers everything. And plus, too, Irving's book on Goebbels is basically an abridged version of Goebbels' diaries. And Irving was the first, Western historian to be granted access to the actual diaries by the Soviet Union, or the Russian Federation. This was like 92, 93, like right after the inter-German border ceased to exist. Ernst Nolte's he was a disciple of Heidegger, so you're talking about very deep meta-history and complex philosophical concepts, but you know, people can start with John Toland and David Irving. And again, this is a huge topic. People need to just make it a study. They need to make a study of history throughout their life. And you study philosophy to interpret history. You study science to interpret history. You study culture and language to interpret history. You study biology to interpret history. You know, and you interpret the evidence and you analyze it over and over and over again. You know, and you take direct testimony and you take, you know, you take the factual record, you know, and you take the record that was left by, you know, political theorists and historians, like in the moment as these things were underway and what they interpreted. And then you've got to like discern based on the knowledge you've aggregated and the kind of analytical processes and instincts you've perfected in your own studies. And like, you need to interpret that correctly. You know, you're not going to find it in some single volume book.
Yeah,
there's not the big book of World War II and all what you've been told is wrong, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with, I guess that's part of the framework is it, you know me, I'm not necessarily looking for a single volume, but I still fall into that trap of the same mentality that thinks that the world is a Saturday morning cartoon Marvel movie, is the same part of the brain where you're like, give me the one book.
Suggesting you or anybody else. Yeah. I mean, like I was just talking some shit and invoking probably an imperfect metaphor, but
yeah,
but it's also like, I, everything I'm doing with Canones and yeah, pretty much everything, about half of the stuff I do on the Substack and on my pod is kind of like what I think of as culture comp stuff. And just, you know, and just like, and just kind of like, you know, stuff I think is significant, like in the culture and in the kind of the historical moment, but about half of it is revisionist stuff. And I mean, Canonis and I have arrayed like a huge amount of freaking content on World War II. Like, I'm not saying like, oh, I'm so smart, you know, but the point is like, I have done this. And if you do, you know, hit up my platforms, like, you, if you want to read revisionism all day, like, you can do it, you know. I mean, so like, that's another place, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, but no, this is great, man. We should do it again, and cover more topics, yeah, in the next couple of weeks. At least I'd like to.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, usually first time I have someone on is kind of an overview, get some background and like kind of big picture, but I'd be honored to have you on again. We'll put your links down below. It's a realthomas777.substack.com. And you can also go over to Twitter, real_7. Well, Thomas, but with the number 7, HOMAS 777. But I'll put that below in the show description.
Thanks. And sorry for the, like, it's like barely freaking cold here. I mean, yeah, it's Chicago. Like, the high today is literally 2 degrees, So like this morning, like things were kind of foobar. It's like, sorry, I had to like push back the time, and but thank you for accommodating me, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I'll often stream for 7 hours at a time, so I'm here every weekday around this time. So no problem at all.
No, that's real work, man. Like that's legit, man. I take my hat off to you. But yeah. Again, I'm being entirely sincere, man. Thank you so much for hosting me, and yeah, let's do this again in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Sounds good, man. Well, have a great day. Love having you on. We'll talk soon, okay?
Yeah, thank you, buddy.
All right, bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Call me ignorant. Thomas777, great times. You love to see it. You can follow me on Rumble. Ignoramus is the channel on Rumble. Follow me on Twitter. JR Normus. Felt like me and Thomas really hit it off there. That was great. It's such a big topic. You know, one final thought I will close with here is that, you know, I don't know nothing about nothing, but I'm inclined to trust the guy that sees things through a not too complex, but a contextual worldview rather than, oh, this guy is like, have you like considered that Hitler was like a bad man and, Putin is like a glorified gas station attendant. And he's just got a guy like that that can just go off the cuff. That dude is writing an essay on the spot. Very learned. And he's humble, too. He's humble. He's like, I could be wrong about this. I see through things through my lens. But the amount of rigor that a guy like that goes into, then we got the people at the top of the other side. They're just like, he's a bad man and they're evil. So love talking to people like that. God bless Thomas777. He said, come back on in the next couple weeks. You love to see it. Call me ignorant. Love you guys. Well, thank you so much for checking out the content today. I really hope that you enjoyed it. If you want to see more of this stuff, you can go over to my link tree and follow all of the different places where you can do my social media and the different places I stream. That's linktr.ee/ignoramusmedia. The top links are Rumble, Odyssey, and my two YouTube channels. I stream 10 a.m. Eastern every single weekday. Usually try to have one or two cool guests per week. But yeah, Ignoramus streams on YouTube, Ignoramus videos on YouTube for streams and videos, Odyssey and Rumble, and the main spot, like I said before, is the Rumble. So if you search Ignoramus over there on Rumble, rumble.com/user/Ignoramus. If anything ever happens as far as censorship, you can always find me on Rumble. But once again, the daily Ignoramus is 10 a.m. Eastern time every single weekday. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you around.